But then we're back in Babylonian times.
But we never destroy the tablets.
Because they're digitally recorded. They're in the cloud.
They're forever.
This was everybody's genius idea with like Bitcoin. They were like, oh, the ledgers are there forever. It's like, it's not as good as you think.
No.
Hey, kids.
Welcome to Volume 1 of the Desiring Capital podcast, where we, Ryan and Jamie, talk about people talking about Marx, and occasionally Marx himself. Today, we're talking about something nobody wants, but everybody has: debt. We got a lot to get through, so on your marks, get set, let's go.
You're back with Ryan and Jamie for part two of volume one. We're going to be talking about the pores of debt and sitting down with David Van Putten.
On this episode, we will discuss, amongst other things, debt. Usually, Luther, the special place in hell Dante has for his family, the Augustine nature of the EUR library return policy, and the Nietzschean nature of video rental chain store Blockbuster.
That's right, Jamie. So let's get going with David in his own words.
In the third volume of Das Kapital, Karl Marx writes, "Usury lives in the pores of production, as it were, just as the gods of Epicurus lived in the space between worlds. What does this mean? What are these pores of production exactly? And how does Marx evaluate the moral economic problem of interest-bearing debt? Marx uses the term usury in the classical sense of a destructive form of money lending. The usurer lends someone money, charges them interest for the use of this money, and takes back more than they have lent, which tends to deepen the malaise of the person they're lending to. One might think this is comparable to the activity of the capitalist. Marx, however, does not see it this way. He writes instead that the usury belongs to the prehistory of capitalism and places it alongside other forms of exploitation, like slavery. This implies not only that usurers do not play a central role in capitalism as Marx describes it, but also that the accusation of usury, so typical of antiquity and the Middle Ages, has become inappropriate. The reason for this is that at some point in history, money has become genuinely productive. In the Politics, Aristotle had written that whereas crops and livestock procreate naturally, money is sterile. Money produces nothing, and when it does multiply through interest, it does so only by leeching off the natural growth of organic wealth, which is why usury should be forbidden. In the era of capitalism, this sterility is placed in doubt. Socio-technical developments bring industries into existence with a rate of growth big enough that they can be nurtured through interest-bearing loans. And despite his misgivings concerning capitalism, Marx recognizes that money's role as an active participant in these industries is not merely an illusion. To be sure, capitalism misrepresents the role of money here by systematically underestimating the contribution of the laborer, but the efficacy of money itself is real. We speak of capitalism only when money begins to act as fuel for the economic machine. Money lending in the process now has the potential to profit both the creditor and the debtor, insofar as the debtor's industry might allow them to outpace the interest rate on their loan. If this happens, the lopsided relation to the usurer is transformed into an even-handed one, an exchange rather than a theft. This change in the role of money is associated with an accompanying change in the moral evaluation of money lending. While Dante still placed the usurers in one of the deepest circles of hell, and while Luther wrote that usurers were second in vice only to Satan, the rise of capitalism is associated with an attenuation of this moral judgment. From the 19th century onwards, it's okay to lend money. It may seem as if this only makes the usurer an even more central figure in capitalism. But if we keep to the strict definition of the usurer as a destructive lender, the usurer can invest in an industry that grows, but this industry will either outgrow the loan, jettisoning the need for the usurer's investment, it might keep pace with the loan, turning the usurer into the de facto capitalist, or it may be overwhelmed by the loan, costing the usurer their investment. Whatever the scenario, the usurer must either become a productive lender, like the capitalist, or be defeated by them. Bad banks will always have to be bailed out. This allows us to make sense of Marx's metaphor. The powerful centrifugal action of capitalist organs, industries, pushes the exploitative moneylender outward, to the pores, where they can eke out a marginal existence by clogging up the works. Epicurus wrote that the gods existed, but that they lived in another dimension, indifferent to human affairs. The usurer, for Marx, belongs in a feudalist world, which still exists, but not in the dialectical epicenter of capitalism. The point of all this is to indicate that debt is not a Marxist problem. In the last decade or two, many philosophers have focused their attention on the creditor-debtor relationship, sometimes with reference to Marx. But this assimilation is fundamentally awkward. The usurer is, at best, only a secondary thief for Marx. They insinuate themselves in mortgages, student loans, and consumer debt. Egregious, to be sure, but ultimately the problem of a vanishing middle class.
What are we actually talking about when we talk about usury, David?
So usury comes from at least the English word comes from a theological context. I think it comes from Thomas Aquinas, who says that you can't charge someone money for the mere use of it. Right. So if I give you 10 euros and you kind of survive through this, and then I say, yeah, I want 12 back, then I'm charging you for the momentary use of this money. And Aquinas says, yeah, it's not really fair. I mean, that's not what money is for. Aquinas is an Aristotelian, right? So he just thinks that money should be used to exchange and nothing else.
Right.
So the temporal elements of the debt shouldn't be counted. It's also what St. Augustine said, right? So he said that interest should be forbidden because it's a price put on time. And time belongs to God.
Time belongs to God means that time should not be a factor or cannot be monetized in a way.
Well, it shouldn't be. It obviously can be.
So doing the exchange in itself would be like worth a fee, right? We have that nowadays as well, right? Like, for instance, you know, when we started moving towards the electronic payments in stores, you would pay like 25 cents because it would be electronic. So you would pay for the method itself, right? It's also kind of interesting that you have to pay to use the medium at all.
Well, now it's hard to use cash.
Now it's hard to use cash. And so time belongs to God, which means that even like renting or lending things and having to pay like fees or even fines for it, that would be a problem then.
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, not all fines, but temporal-based ones.
That means like Blockbuster, terrible usurers.
Terrible.
Late fees. And they get the same video back that I took out.
Yeah, you get it. You get something. You have it for a little bit. You give it back.
Yeah, but in contrast, as Erasmus University Library, I had insane late fees. But when I got them the books back, they did not charge me anything.
No, they read Augustine.
See? Very learned. A very learned Erasmian library staff.
Exactly.
Yes.
And Blockbuster, as usurers, went bankrupt.
And they were Nietzscheans.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, all right. In a way, like the home TV killed God, and Blockbuster was trying to give you the content that would make that TV worthy of the crime of killing. It was trying to provide you the good content that would make it worth having a TV in your home instead of God. Nietzsche.
I don't remember this book.
We were just talking about St. Augustine. You know who else condemned usury?
I am frightened to ask at this point.
It's this little-known man called Luther.
I'm sorry, you'll have to be more specific.
I'm talking about Martin Luther.
Oh.
Yes.
Ooh. What was his position? I bet it was pretty like cool, like religiously and ethnically.
Well, so he wrote this book, and it starts out on the Jews.
Never a promising start. But thus far, more of a neutral stance than I thought it would be.
Could be neutral, but then he continues.
Well, please no.
And their lies.
Yikes.
And it's even worse than you think.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no, it's pretty bad. So one thing he does is that he calls for what he calls remedial actions, which are supposed to purge.
Did they fail high school? Well,
it's supposed to purge, basically, Protestant countries of the Jewish contingents. And basically, the first thing you should do is burn down synagogues.
Oh.
It's pretty bad. But also, number six, and this is why we came to it, usury is as their primary occupation is to be prohibited and for all Jews' silver and gold to be removed, put aside for safekeeping, and given back to the Jews who truly convert. So imagine that, all those Protestants have to save Martin Luther, the great reformer. I mean, so it's known that, they kind of do this where they're like, oh, yeah, no, Martin Luther's great, except for this work. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, they're a little more tightly knit than you think.
Well, let's, I mean, here we are, right, in the Netherlands, in Holland, no less. I mean, this is Protestant Central right here. And they still, by the way, I should add, Protestant time number one here, usury happening all over the place. Should be clarified.
Yeah, apparently Luther was so bad that even his Protestant friends were like, whoa, Martin, you know, that's you're going a little far there.
Yeah, when you got like five Dutch Anabaptists from Leiden who are like, hey, calm it down, bro. Yeah. Like, you know you're on the wrong track.
Yeah.
Wrong track.
Very wrong.
Yes. Well, I guess continuing our sort of litany of the great usury haters of history, another figure you brought up, David, Dante.
Yes, because with La Divina Commedia, we find usury in one of the circles of hell as well.
Ooh, how deep? I bet it's deep.
Usury is in the last stage of the seventh circle, which is pretty far down, by the way. Violence.
Violence.
Violence. Usury is violent. Right before we go into the eighth circle, which would be fraud, protected, or
it has a it's farrier.
Yes, it has a
a farrier.
A farrier in the name of Garion, a bat winged figure as the image of fraud.
Leather bat wing. But with a scorpion's tail.
A scorpion's tail?
Yes. Ah. The image of fraud. Do you know why?
No.
Because when you look into that man face and you see those leather bat wings, you think, well, I've seen it all. And that's when he stabs you with his scorpion tail. Fraud.
And then the ninth circle, which is treachery, represented by Satan.
Lake of Ice.
Lake of Ice. The
for
most
people, for Lucifer and Craig. You know what you did, Craig.
As Lucifer was the biggest baddie of them all by betraying God himself. Therefore, he is the deepest in hell. But usurers are pretty close, being in the seventh circle. What makes usurers violent?
Oh, because they destroy by lending. If you lend to someone who you know can never pay you back, or they can never grow enough in order to outstrip the interest rate, then you're destroying their lives. The other violent aspect of the creditors, of course, that they can also have a desire for vengeance. I mean, there's all Shakespearean Shylock trope, or the mafia, or whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's also a definitely violent aspect of the usurer. I just always like that Dante example because it's such a clear expression of how much usurers were hated. I mean, they're deeper than most people. Deeper than murderers.
Deeper than murderers, yeah.
Yeah.
Bordering on fraud.
I think this is pretty typical of much of the Middle Ages. It's certainly not one of Dante's aberrations.
No, no, for sure. But it's still good that he has a special place in hell for his family.
I have no strong opinions on the bat, but you don't on have any.
No, no.
On Garion.
No,
no strong opinions on Garion.
I was starting to think there's Satan and there's three people around him.
Yeah.
Judas.
Judas, of course, classic.
Craig apparently, but there's also like
no, you nailed it. It's Lucifer, Judas, and Craig.
It's very much in the spirit of Dante just to put random people from your life that you hate.
Oh, and over there, that's, you know, famous biblical figure one. Over here, that's Greek mythology figure number two. And number three, that's Giovanni from Pisa, that piece of shit. And that's basically the Divina Commedia for you right there.
Always so petty.
Yeah. It's how it is. It's like, you betrayed Jesus. Yeah. You betrayed God, and you never returned my fucking knife set. I've been looking for that for years.
You guys are horrible, but wait till you hear about this woman that I saw from a distance in the church one time.
Now, David, you also mentioned that Marx talks about how the pores of capitalism operate like Epicurean gods in the interrealms, as it were, the space between worlds. Only for Epicurus, the gods don't really do anything. They don't intervene in any real way. But financial capital now, even though it might operate in this in-between realm, this digital realm, it acts like a Christian god in that it giveth and it taketh away.
Yeah, but we have to be very careful about that we distinguish everything. So, I mean, what is financial capital really doing? Because that would be the question for Marx, right? So if financial capital is injecting its money into spheres of productivity, right? So it becomes industrial capital. It has all its capital wrapped up in an industry. Then it's simply, you know, becoming part of capitalism. It's not in the pores. It's in the organs. But if it has a different strategy, let's say someone who lends in terms of consumer debt, that for him would be the kind of last vestige of the usurer.
Yeah, but I was thinking more like a CDO, right? A collateralized debt obligation, when I mean instrument in that sense, right? Like, because you're demarcating these two definitions of financialization or finance, right? Mm. And with regard to debt, where would you put then something that is a pure instrument in that sense, made of debts, like a CDO, right? Like a collateralized debt obligation, where it's not even about directly servicing or taking out the debt, but rather packaging these products in such a way that the future servicing of this debt and its reliability plays into its volatility, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where I'm kind of going with the financialization of it. When debt ceases to be seen through this creditor-debtor lens, even.
So when it becomes abstract from the original debt, so you have a kind of debt squared.
Debt
of the debt.
Double debt.
I mean, it obviously adds new problems to the mix. So you have the problem that was kind of the problem of the last big financial crisis, right? The 2007-2008. The problem of, okay, you have these complex financial products that nobody's even sure what they exactly refer to. And as soon as someone kind of opens the black box and looks in, realizes it's not worth anything, then the entire system collapses, right? Well, I think one thing I'd like to say about it is that it's not new, right? So a lot of these financial products have already existed for a very long time. I mean, in Holland, they had something called wind trade, which is basically this trade in very complex financial products, which was like trading in the wind.
Wind trade? Oh, so like Enron? Like where they're trading in like electricity and so half of California doesn't have power or what?
No, I think it's more like a colloquialism where...
Oh, I thought it was so much more than that.
Yeah, no, you just buy up a lot of stuff and then you hope that it becomes worth more in the future and then you can sell at a later date. Like, it's just a speculative bubble, basically.
So that has existed, but it is very prominent now. So what is its role? One of its roles is just pure obfuscation. Because I think the real problem... The real problem now is that, so you have a legitimization of debt because debt becomes important in realizing productive capacities. However, much of the debt we encounter now isn't invested in any productivity, which would just make it simply usury.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be somehow concealed or made complicated by a variety of abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
It would have an ideological role in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. I actually think that was a really interesting point because when you talk about financialization, you do have to differentiate, really. What do you mean, right? And I think you're getting at something really interesting here when I think you said it, right? Like debt squared. It's not debt even considered, right, as an abstraction, but it's debt being repackaged to serve another economic purpose besides the initiation of this debtor-creditor relationship. The moralization of debt is kind of everywhere the same as opposed to the specific mechanisms of each debt structure. But finance seems to escape this a little bit. Mm. And in finance, debt is one place where it behaves much differently than it does for other people than it does in our daily lives.
Maybe it's just also an extrapolation of a tendency that's inherent in debt itself. Because it's not just the financial products that are an abstraction of, let's say, the underlying debts, the mortgages which the financial product is composed of. It's also that debt itself is an abstraction of a social relation. So let's say I have a vague sense of obligation towards you. Is that a debt? Ooh. Not necessarily. It becomes an obligation when, you know, that becomes quantified,
mm-hmm.
right? Or and not just quantified, but also registered that I owe you X. And as soon as that's there, as soon as that abstraction is there and it becomes objective, it's very difficult to argue with it. I think you'll find in practice, especially in our time. Because if you look in the past, I mean, there's this whole interesting prehistory of debt that people like Michael Hudson go into, where they show that, oh, if you look in ancient Babylon, then there was all sorts of debt crises and fights over debt and people protesting the debts that they have. So you had these clay tablets on which debts were registered, and people would say, no, it's time for those tablets to be smashed. It's time to
end
this particular debt crisis. But there's something about debt in our time that people are not as likely to do this, right? You don't see any widespread outrage over these financial products and the amount you supposedly owe. I mean, you're born innocent, let's say, and at some point you learn through the mail that you owe money or that you're part of a collective that owes money. And most people are like, yeah, all right, that makes sense. Yeah. That's interesting.
Just the kind of acceptance of it
as
part of living today.
I guess it also makes somebody responsible, right? So obviously you collect that debt from within society in some sense to do something that you think, in this case, you know, if you think of like Rotterdam, where they have like building projects, and usually you have like external money come in, and then they think they can make this profitable, so they kind of take some money that they have or take debt with people, with this promise of being able to earn it back, but also kind of you indebt yourself to society, but then also you try to exploit that very same society to make it back to some other folks who use the digital realm to move money around, right? I mean,
I think the richer you become, the more you can use your own debt as an instrument.
Right.
Right. So a lot of that moralization kind of becomes less once you're able to disassociate your debt from...
Yeah, nobody faults any, you know, super rich folks with having maybe more debt than they can pay, or at any time, more debt than the money they earn or whatever. That's totally fine. Right, you don't have any moral problem there.
That's the difference between being poor and having cash flow problems, right?
Right.
That kind of implies that the flow is at some point going to come back to you, and then you'll be, you'll be fine.
Yeah. So in a sense, those who you are indebted to have more faith in your ability to come back from it or earn it back.
Yeah, there's also a power dynamic at play there, right? So there's a quote from Raber's book on debt, but it's also, I think, a common saying where people say, well, if you owe the bank $10 million, then the bank owns you. Mm. But if you owe the bank $10 billion, then you own the bank. And then there's this weird dependency relationship that starts to emerge between the bank cannot allow you to go bankrupt, right? Because that would look very bad for their investors. And I think that some people are just very good at managing this.
And now time for a commercial break.
I'm Jamie.
And I'm Ryan.
And we're here to tell you about a special offer.
That's right, Jamie. Now, what we have here, this is rare.
Oh, well, what do we have?
I'm glad you asked, Jamie. We have here some of the finest business practices of the rich. And we are here to give it to you.
That's right, everybody. Here, we're talking about some of the prime,
top shelf debt in the world. A luxe selection for the world's richest. You take this kind of debt on, you're practically already rich.
Tired of paying a mortgage or a car payment? Or maybe you bought that last clothing order in installments? Get out of here!
You haven't leveraged yourself enough! Get so much you can never pay it back!
And now you're looking for that mansion!
Leverage it! That Ferrari!
Leverage it! That shiny social media company!
Leverage it! And that's why we're here to give you this offer. At only $500 million and 99 cents, you can have 15, 20, 30 times that and never have to pay it back.
You know what? For today, just for today, you guys, I'm feeling crazy. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to make a special offer.
What?
Yeah, that's right. $250.99.
No, this is theft. I can't.
No, Jamie, that's where you're wrong. You can give us a call today and you can live like the mega rich. Don't miss out.
I used to have this roommate who was a kind of debt fugitive, I guess. So people would come by in the middle of the night, ring our doorbell, and just threaten him.
Oh.
Because he owed all sorts of places. He owed the money. And when these people were inside and like shaking him up and down, he'd be like, yeah, I'm going to pay. As soon as they were out the door, he'd be like, you know.
And then... most ineffective intimidation ever.
That's goldfish style. Just like, what were we talking about?
Yeah. And at some point, I was so amused by him because, I mean, people would, like, we had some roommates studying economics and business, and we're like, hey, if you want some help with your finances, we can help you. He'd be like, no, I'm fine. And you just buy a new television, new speaker, et cetera.
And what are you talking about? I got this covered. I just got this new kick-ass TV.
Yeah. And at some point, I thought, okay, he's going to be in big trouble. But then he just disappeared. And what happened was he moved to a different city, and apparently it takes quite a long time for the registration to catch up.
Oh.
So he could stay ahead of his creditors for a while. And for weeks after this, like, these disappointed bailiffs would come by, like, where is he? Like, yeah, he moved. Like, ah.
But so, I mean, you don't want a system where it's like either you behave and pay all your debts or you're an asshole for ducking everybody and, you know, never paying back or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I think we have the system where even those people who do have the let's say, the debt conscience and definitely want to pay.
Right.
Those are also now in debt. So, I mean, debt is one thing, right? It's one thing to have debt. And the problem with debt isn't just that you actually have very little to survive on. Because usually there is kind of this space permitted to you by the creditors and
right subsistence.
Yeah, but the worst thing is just the kind of weight of it. Mm. Right. So this is just something you find in literature thousands of years back. So if you read Aristophanes, it's about he talks about not being able to sleep because of all of your creditors. It's right. I mean, that's even worse than the things that kind of factually happen to you.
So the one who suffers the most is the upright citizen who cannot sleep themselves because of their creditors wanting them or needing their money, maybe, right?
Bad conscience is the worst. Well, it's like Kafka has this thing where he says it's worse to think about being hanged than it is to actually be hanged. Mm. The anticipation is much worse than the execution.
Could you imagine being like a debt bailiff or whatever they would be called and then having a debt bailiff come to you?
Yeah.
I know why you're here, man. Sorry.
Yeah. Can you imagine just being a debt bailiff?
Oh, yeah. They made a, you know, it was crazy. They made a reality show out of it in the UK.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, I've seen this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's wild.
Oh, my. Is it any good? Like, or well,
I mean, no, but it's like, it's just like usually two dudes.
Yeah, they're, of course it's dudes.
They're like, go in there. They go in and they're like, you know, oi, mate, you owe us a damn fiver. No. But like, obviously, they're like, you know, you can't be off buying TVs and such. So bread pudding, apples and pears.
So they repo it or?
Yeah, or like they figure out an interim thing. Mm. But it's, you know, but they're like cops.
Mm.
They're not like... Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's bad. It would be way more interesting if it was actually like a loan shark.
Unless it's like the guy, like, comes, who's like, I'm just ready with my books. Time to collect my money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You took Tottenham on the spread. You're done, buddy.
You know what's a cool book about this? Max recommended it to me, actually. You know Alfred Jarry, right? The pataphysics guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he wrote this Dr. Faustro, I think the name is. And it starts with, it's about this guy, Dr. Faustro, and he's a professor in...
I'm sorry, I have to do this, but Fausthole?
Faustro. It's about a guy called Dr. Faustro. Like,
oh, how do you Faust? Yeah. Oh, okay, okay.
With an R.
I keep thinking of Faust, and then I heard Fausthole.
Fausthole.
But this guy is like...
up your Fausthole.
Yeah, up your Fausthole.
He's like an expert in pataphysics, which is the science of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, a dead bailiff comes by his house. And the guy is obviously based on Alfred Jarry himself, who was an alcoholic and had all these money problems, etc. The dead bailiff comes, and Dr. Faustro is like, okay, you have to come in. And then it turns out his house isn't just a slum. It's actually kind of like a Nautilus-style machine of, that travels through worlds.
Oh,
and he
nice.
Takes the dead bailiff with him. He basically turns him into his shipmate.
Uh-huh.
He takes him on an exploration of possibilities.
Nice. Mm-hmm. How do you want to spoil the end? Like, what happens then?
I don't remember. This is never going to be in it, but... It's a good
story.
No,
I think it should, actually. I think it's a good choice. I think the whole Faustro thing was great.
The Fausthole?
The Fausthole. Up your Fausthole.
That's like a really dark K-hole. The Fausthole.
So picking back up the thread of the CDOs, what I thought was interesting is that it's not that like difficult of an instrument, right? It's clearly like a black box, a new mystification of, you know, a way of selling you something that you know you can't sell to anybody. And already in 2005, so that's years before any type of crisis arose, there were articles that said CDOs are a shell game. You know, like the trick game that you can play on or that is played on some street.
Three card Monty,
where, you know, you have to pick.
Where's the pretty lady?
Where's the pretty lady? Where's the ball?
That's right.
And so it was never not known that CDOs are problematic, you know, or it's like a game of musical chairs in which, you know, everybody has to kind of find their spot. But then when the music stops, you're left with the big pile of debt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons like, hey, Zachary Quinto, talk to me like a golden retriever, please.
Exactly.
You know? Bankers never know what's going on, man.
Please sit down. Welcome, everyone. I must apologize for dragging you all here at such an uncommon hour, but from what I've been told, this matter needs to be dealt with urgently. Why doesn't somebody tell me what they think is going on here?
Mr. Tulled, as I mentioned earlier, if you compare the figure at the top of page 13...
Jared, it's a little early for all that. Just speak to me in plain English. But I'd like to speak to the guy who put this together. Mr. Sullivan, is it? Does he speak English? Oh, Mr. Sullivan, you're here. Good morning. Maybe you could tell me what you think is going on here. And please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever. It wasn't brains that got me here, I can assure you of that.
The key factor here is these are essentially just mortgages, so that has allowed us to push the leverage considerably beyond what you might be willing or allowed to do in any other circumstance, thereby pushing the risk profile without raising any red flags.
And Mr. Sullivan, what does your model say that means for us here?
Well, that's where it becomes a projection. But, well, sir... If those assets decrease by just 25% and remain on our books, that loss would be greater than the current market capitalization of this entire company.
So, what you're telling me is that music is about to stop, and we're going to be left holding the biggest bag of odorous excrement ever assembled in the history of capitalism.
Sir, I'm not sure that I would put it that way, but let me clarify, using your analogy, what this model shows is the music, so to speak, just slowing. If the music were to stop, as you put it, then this model wouldn't be even close to that scenario. It would be considerably worse.
Let me tell you something, Simon. Do you care to know why I'm in this chair with you all? I mean, why I earn the big bucks?
Yes.
I'm here for one reason, one reason alone. I'm here to guess what the music might do a week, a month, a year from now. That's it. Nothing more. I'm standing here tonight. I'm afraid that I don't hear a thing. Just silence.
We want to thank David Van Putten for coming into the studio and sitting in with us. We also want to thank the rest of the DNC team for helping make these events possible. I also want to thank Linus, our in-house designer, and Maximilians, the editor extraordinaire. I also want to thank Daniel Nolet and Nazar for sound editing. Thanks, everybody. Peace. Make it to 27. Pox ain't make it to 26. Big ain't make it to 25. It's only right that I gotta get rich. Cut niggas off and I curse niggas out. Niggas thirsty for help with some motherfucking drought. Niggas envy when you famous first. They don't know what they name is worth. Please excuse my grammar. See my eyes can feel with Anna. This game like Home Depot, bitch. They got keys, hoes, and hammers. Niggas, gangsters, killers, and scammers. We was out dodging bullets and cameras. When you broke, niggas won't throw slander. Get money, now your ass can't.